It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, my special guest for this second hour. We have Robert Wheel. Now, he is author of Red Cat, White Cat. Let's go ahead and pull that book up there. China and the Contradictions of Market Socialism. Market socialism. We're going to find out what that means. Can you have is it a free market, a socialism market, and what kind of market? Can you have a market and it not be free? I mean, you know, these kind of things we need to talk about. Plus, we're going to be talking about China and India, now with each other and, of course, with U.S. relations with China and India. Now, he's retired now, but he's doing a lot of writing focusing on India and the contrasts and similarities in the Chinese and Indian situations as relate to the world market. Now, I want to talk about your book, Robert Wheel. Am I saying your last name right, Wheel?
No, it's Wild.
Wild. Okay, Robert Wheel. Now, Robert, let's go ahead and talk about your book, Red Cat, White Cat. What was the reason for you writing that, and what was it about?
I was in China in 1993-94, up in the northeast part of the country, teaching and then traveling down through the rest of a good part of the rest of China. And the book grew out of, first of all, years of following the Chinese Revolution and its twists and turns.
Okay, go ahead and give us the years, the revolution from?
Well, it started in the 20s, but the communists took power in 1949. I was a student of the entire period, and what we saw in 1993-94 was the new, more capitalistic policies that had been initiated by Deng Xiaoping after Mao died in 1976. They were finally coming in full force up in the northeast where we were. But what we were able to see was the sort of last of the old socialistic system that Mao had built up, being converted to this new, more capitalistic approach that Deng Xiaoping had taken.
Well, let's go ahead and stop.
And we saw that even more as we traveled then through the southern parts of the country.
Okay, let's go ahead and define that because, you know, more capitalist. You know, I want to make sure that we get our terms understood here, mm-hmm. so that we're not, you know, not understanding each other. When you say a more capitalistic form, what does that mean? I mean, were they allowed private property rights? Was it really more of a fascist thing, or were they actually having courts protecting private property? I mean, what does that mean?
Okay. Well, it was a somewhat gradual process spread out over a couple of decades, really. Unlike, for instance, what happened in Russia after, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, where within just 3 or 4 years, you had a complete sort of overturn of the system. In China, what they began with was dismantling the rural communes that had been set up actually in the late 50s during the time of the Great Leap Forward. And these were very large-scale agricultural combines that not only were production units but provided schooling and health care and other services to the peasants, and where people did not farm their individual plots of land. What happened when they broke those up was that they reverted to a so-called family responsibility system where each household was assigned a portion of land to work individually and to market their crops, etc. So that was the beginning of the so-called reforms that Deng Xiaoping brought in. And then when they came to the cities, they began allowing small-scale private enterprise, sort of mom-and-pop stuff, but then began to dismantle the state-owned industries, which had been the sort of urban counterpart to the rural collectives. These were usually very large-scale industrial combines in which the workers, again, not only had social services provided, but also their housing. And they began to either privatize those outright or, in many cases, kind of semi-privatize them, turning them into profit-making corporations controlled by party and state officials, by the managers, and then increasingly by outside investors as well.
Okay, now let me ask some questions here. Now, I really appreciate this history. This is really good stuff. Now, what happens is we look at, let's say, a Soviet-planned economy or a communist-planned way that China was doing it. Mm-hmm. They would have what we would learn in school in the 70s and 80s and such, you know, a five-year plan. You know, how many albums of Bach are they going to get? How many gallons of vanilla ice cream is going to be made? I mean, it was just, you know, excuse me. How many of whatever fill in the blank, they had to have it planned, and then they would gear up production to do whatever it was they were going to plan. Now, demand, you know, was, I don't know, whatever somebody on top of the hill said there was going to be a demand for, and they would fill the supply. It's a very inefficient and weird way of doing it. Now, of course, they're of the mind is that, yeah, but if you make a whole bunch of vanilla ice cream and you do it at one time, and you can get a real good efficiency and cheap making of vanilla ice cream. It doesn't matter whether anybody wants it or not, but that's what you do. Then, well, let me go ahead and finish. So what they did is they go, all right, we're going to try and use individual incentives for people to have their own property in the rural areas that they would be incentivized by being able to keep what's theirs and they produce and they could sell in the market and everything. And all of a sudden, I would imagine there was an enormous increase in the production of food. You do the same thing with any kind of capital goods or commodities or, you know, things of need and, you know, spatulas and frying pans and whatever in more urban areas. And that would happen also. But what they did is they started to replace this command economy. They would have different companies and corporations turned over to private. But of course, as with Russia, I'm sure it was party officials that took over this kind of production. So this is my question. When you have a dispute on the property in the rural areas, or you have competition wants to come in and manufacture something in the urban areas, what is the role of the government? Is it to protect the individual that has, hey, man, this guy's encroaching on my property, or this guy, I want to compete, and this guy won't let me? Is the government takes which side? You're not allowed to make the new better mousetrap because we already got a party official that owns a company that does it. I mean, you know, so that's my next level. Once they start to go to this kind of private property and use of private capital, what is the role of the government in that system as they transition?
Well, you threw out a lot of stuff there. Let me try and address some of the issues, and I'll address that at the end, your last question, okay? One, the kind of...
Oh, we got to wait until after the break to do it.
Okay.
Yeah, I you know, this is good point where we can, you know, pick it up when we come back.
Okay.
Robert Weil is here talking about China. His personal experiences there, a long time study of it and living there, being exposed to it, wrote the book. Red cat, white cat, China and the contradiction of market socialism, and what's going to be happening with the United States in relations with India and China and India. We'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock. I'm on the upswing. I'm starting to feel a little better. But we got Robert Wiles is going to help me out here. He's going to fill the time that normally I'd be yakking because he's got a lot to say. And let me go ahead and pull this up. Here's a map of China and India, and they share a common border for, it looks like probably at least hundreds of miles. And it's they dominate the Asian economy right now. And I'm wondering, you know, the relationships between them is going to be what? India was a British colony at one time, and now they're not. And China kicked out during the Boxer Rebellion and so on, kind of Western influences there back in the day and been on their own. And there's a whole bunch of Chinese going to do what they want to do. Now, this is, before we move on any further, we're talking to Robert Weil. And he's the author of Red Cat, White Cat, China and the Contradictions of Market Socialism. And the one thing that I wanted to let you go on in this segment to talk about is how it is when you got a command economy that's got their 1, 5, 10 lifetime plan for you or whatever it is, and all of a sudden they decide, you know what, we're going to get you off the big giant commune and we're going to give you a family plot. We're going to let you, you know, farm that. Well, then you got a contradiction with your neighbor, you know, some kind of difference of opinion or whatever. So where's the court? What's the role of government?
Okay, well, let me address the issues you raised. Let me make three points. One is, yes, there are inefficiencies in both kinds of systems, okay? But just going back historically, the Soviet Union, using the kinds of plans that you were mentioning, industrialized probably more rapidly than any other society ever had, to the point where they were able to defeat the German invasion and become rivals with the United States as a superpower. That's not complete inefficiency, in my view. And the Chinese under the socialist era, under Mao, also carried out a lot of industrialization and development. So just historically, it's not accurate to say that, you know, they were just stumbling along with no development, no innovation until the capitalist system came back in.
Well, this is my point, Robert, so that we can, and I know we're of a different philosophical opinion here. I'm a libertarian, and you're probably not. But the point that I'm making is that whenever we talk about the advancement of a society, it, from my perspective, is the proper role of government. The only justification for an existence.
I will allow you to address it
as soon as I make my point.
Well, you've made a lot of points.
My point is that to look at the advancement of a society and what they can create, you know, in the terms of like roads or dams or all that kind of stuff, means nothing to me. It's what do they do to advance the individual rights of all the individuals. For them, freedom is the goal, in my opinion. Now, when you look at what a socialist market-based economy has created as a society, is not necessarily what I'm looking for as how that equates to the individual. So that's why I ask questions about how are the individuals protected, because when you give a family plot to someone and you say, here, why would they do that? Because they think that the individual would be more productive doing using market forces to accomplish and create food that would serve the whole more than if they were on a collective. So now that they have that, I want to know how they measure the support of that. Do they protect that individual rights, or is it really not, and it's just a mechanism by which to get them to be more productive? So You know, we can have different opinions. I just want to know how the government looks to someone that is, they're increasing their productivity because they're giving them ownership of something that's now their responsibility. And when it's challenged, who's challenging it and who's protecting that challenge? Is the government taking away from it? Let's say somebody becomes enormously productive. Can they combine? They'll buy other people's farms. They get into some kind of a co-op. Do they do? And they go, ah, that's too big. They cut it up. Or they, you know, you see what I mean?
Look, I didn't come on here to just listen to you, okay? If you want me to address these issues, give me time to do it. Otherwise, let's stop it, okay?
Waiting on you now.
Thank you. Okay, first of all, there's questions of what you want to get out of a kind of system. I explained that one of the major aspects of the socialist period, when there was all these collective forms of organization, was that both peasants and workers had guarantees, basically, of their jobs, of health care, of educational resources, of old age protection, etc. Production was not the only goal by any means. It was to provide these kinds of securities to working people in ways that they had never had, you know, for millennia in China. And they did accomplish to an amazing extent in a poor country to provide those kinds of benefits to working people, to, you know, hundreds of millions of working people. Now, what's happened with the dissolution of the collective forms of organization is, yes, they have provided the kind of individual incentives that you're talking about, and these have allowed for a certain kind of enormous productivity to develop that we're all experiencing with China today. But which is, one, fueled to a very great extent by foreign investment, not simply by domestic development, and secondly, has been done at the cost of tens of millions of workers in the cities being laid off, many of them remaining jobless, of polarization in the countryside, where you now have wealthy farmers in some cases, and local government officials ripping off the land to sell to developers, while other peasants, other farmers, are increasingly left unable to survive in the countryside. And now you have 130, 150, nobody knows the exact figure, of migrant workers coming into the cities to do the export industries, exploited brutally in factories, working 80 hours a week, earning $100 a month at most, under often horrendous conditions. You know, if that's the kind of society you want, then that's what China is developing. You know, if you want 50 million people unemployed in, without health insurance in the United States, and you want, you know, 10% unemployment, or close to it, you know, that's the system you're advocating.
When we come back, Robert's going to help us understand what he would advocate. How would we go back to what China was doing before? Can America do that? Should we do that? What's the method by which we would provide? What do we need to provide? You know, we'll get to that when we come back. What is it that we are required to provide? Are we required? Why are we required? These are good questions Robert's going to help me out with when we come back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock. My guest, Robert Weil, is the author of Red Cat, White Cat, China, and the Contradictions of Market Socialism. And this is an interesting conversation. We'll get to India here in just a little bit, I'm sure. But I wanted to get from Robert what he, because we have three very interesting examples. We have the United States that, we haven't had a free market in the United States since certainly my lifetime, and I was born in 61. We have China, which was a central planned economy, you know, since forever, and they're starting to get more and more individual incentivized in order to increase production that's been successful in limited ways. And then we have India that has an enormous population, and I'm not really sure what they're doing right now. And I wanted to ask Robert, what would it be as we're having this flux in China and India? And certainly the United States is, we're kind of in this mishmash. I'm not even sure what we would call it. What is it that you would advocate?
Well, I don't know very many people who want to or think that the clock can simply be turned back in China. But there are many people, and growing numbers actually in China itself, who feel that the present system, with its extreme polarization of wealth now in China, like in the United States, and very high levels of corruption and growing discontent of many kinds within the society, would like to see more of the collective organization that was there formally reintroduced. So there's a growing left in China that's advocating returning to some of the earlier policies. And there's also an enormous number of protests in China by working people and even increasingly by members of the middle class against corruption, against the taking away of lands, against poor working conditions, environmental catastrophes, all kinds of things. So that's going on in China, and certainly represents, something closer to my point of view than the current just out of control capitalistic style development.
Inject here a little bit. You know, I can see where you're going with that. I mean, you don't want to destroy the earth. You don't want to live in pollution. You don't want to have, but all these, you know, from my perspective, are just property rights issues. You know, if you're polluting my stuff, if I'm going to have a government, I want them protecting, you know, my property, you know, my air, my mine. And I'm going, you know, if we went back, like you're saying, turn back the clock to where you had the government took care of everything, health care and so on, what they found over decades of trying to do this very thing is that there wasn't enough productivity or incentive out of the individuals that made up the society to produce what it took to take care of everybody. So they go, we need to have greater production. So we're going to give some kind of a, you know, individual market incentives for them to increase production. Okay, they increase production. We go, you got increased production now. Now we're going to go back and we're going to take the excess that we say is excess for you, and we're going to redistribute it to everyone. And that's where you're talking about the protests and so on going on now. They're saying, look, we've given you the ability and the incentive and the opportunity to make all of this. Now we need to redistribute it, you know. And I'm going, will that kill it? Will that bring it back to where you were before and you won't have the excess? And is there another solution? And let's talk about India a little bit. Where are they at now? How are they coming out of this?
Well, what's happening in India is similar to China. They started a bit later, but in the 1990s, they also switched over to a neoliberal kind of approach to their economic development, dismantling whatever they had, basically, of state organized industries, etc., inviting in vast amounts of foreign capital, basically subordinating themselves to the globalized market with similar results, which is now you've got growing numbers of billionaires in India at the top and a vast impoverishment at the bottom. And many of the same kinds of disputes and struggles are going on in India. They have their own character there. The biggest difference is that there is now a very large-scale, self-defined Maoist revolution going on in India, that controls in one degree or another about one-third of the country, and not one-third of the population, but one-third of the geographic territory, and that has been declared by the Indian Prime Minister to be the most significant internal security threat that they face. So there's an irony here, obviously, in the fact that while there are Maoist so-called forces in China that are kind of reviving, the real large-scale example of that now is not in China itself, but is in India. And they're looking also to develop new economic and political forms that give working people a chance to survive and to have a real role in running the society, which they're virtually totally denied now, despite the fact that they've got a vote in elections, but on a day-to-day basis, they really have virtually no power to affect what's going on in their lives.
So what's your solution?
Well, I think that these kinds of revolutionary changes are in order. I think that, you can debate the exact form they ought to take, and I certainly do that. But I think that these societies are not meeting the needs of hundreds of millions of their people. I don't think this society where we live is either. And I think that we need, more fundamental changes. Again, one can debate what form that.
Well, that's what I want to talk about. Yeah. I mean, we have such a great example here, Robert. We have India, China, United States, Russia. I mean, the entire planet's in flux. And there is a lot of good things that are examples of what we'd like to see and bad examples of what we wouldn't. And the one thing that we do see, and I don't think that even you would dispute, is that the more individuals are rewarded for their productivity, the more productivity you get out of them. And the thing is that you're going, okay, well, what about the people that are not productive? Or is it because they were limited by opportunity? Is it because government said, they weren't allowed to compete with somebody that had a shiny badge that got there first to do whatever? So it's not really a free market? Or do we, collectivize it to be able to, provide whatever some people are able to produce for everybody? Is it, so I'm looking at, and I'm open-minded, what works, works. And I'm asking you, what works? What was it you're advocating?
Again, it's partly a question of your definition of what works. I mean,
the individual.
You're fixated on this question of the individual
because that's all that counts.
As an abstraction, and on productivity as an abstraction. Okay, but if I'm employed as an individual worker in a Chinese factory, and I'm forced to work 80 hours a week for $100 a month,
forced
and forced to live in a dorm with seven other people in my room and no time off, basically, and you get the rewards of that. I mean, if you want to call that, individual productivity, you're free to do so.
Yeah, see, the word
force. I call it extreme exploitation, and it's not a system that I particularly favor.
Nor would I. The word force does not come into a libertarian mindset.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence of me, Ernest Hancock, on my way back to life. Well, I'm getting there. Starting to feel a little bit better. We have Robert Weil on, and he's lived in China. He's written about it. And we're talking about the socioeconomic policies of various governments. And I'm wanting to make sure that we understand that we're speaking the same language. Now, Robert, before we were cut off by the clock, He's describing the working conditions in China to where people were forced, and I want to get the definition of that, to where they're working long hours. They're getting exploited. I mean, heck, you know, China is even, you know, getting prisoners and working them and, you know, getting some body organs. I mean, you know, it's bad. You know, this is what happens with collectives. But I'm just going, you know, let's try and see if we can walk through what would be a solution. How is and who would be in charge? And who's in charge of the people in charge? So I want to ask Robert again, you know, let you finish your thought. If we don't want people exploited or having to be forced to work, are you talking about the force of the market or somebody actually forcing them?
Well, I'm not clear what you're asking. I mean, the present situation in China is that, you know, hundreds of millions of workers and peasants are struggling for survival under very difficult circumstances. Some have actually benefited from the present organization of the economy in all classes. But tens of millions have lost their jobs, and hundreds of millions are barely surviving on the farms. Now, there's obviously an economic compulsion that's involved in this, but there's also a great deal of state force that's used within this system. You know, demonstrations are put down, and sometimes quite brutally. You know, people are cleared off their land by force. So it's not, you know, it's not a question of either or any more than it is in the United States. I mean, you know, how many picket lines are limited or broken up by the police in various ways? You know, this idea that one system is just a total individual freedom to do anything you want without the state intervening, and the other is the exact opposite, you know, is just not true.
No, I'm saying having any system, that's not going to happen. It's having systems that's the problem in my mind. But,
well,
you know, so I have to ask this question, is that is there a – let's assume that you're going to have some kind of a government. And you would say, all right, if you're going to have this government and it's going to have – because what governments do is govern – and then who are they going to govern? Well, this border, you know, these people inside this line on the map. And they should what? Provide a minimum something? And what is that minimum? And who decides? And how is it distributed? I mean, you know, I'm just – because you get to the point as time goes on and we have, you know, such good examples in history and the internet and the accumulation of information in the form of video and talk shows. I mean, it's just lots of information to where – youth growing up now can look at it and go, you know, it doesn't look like a lot of these systems have been working at all. How about, you know, I want to be a leave me alonist. You know, I want to be, you know, you don't bother me. I want to be whatever, we'll take care of it ourselves. And you go, well, you can't. And you go, well, I want the freedom to try. Well, you can't. Well, then you're not free. I mean, it just, these kind of questions come out. So I'm looking, if you're going to have a government to justify its existence, what do you think they should be doing to be a good government? I mean, maybe not perfect, but to be, you know, the dial kind of goes towards being good because they what? What defines them as being good?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, I didn't come on your program to debate abstractly forms of government, you know, whatever.
What did you
come
on for?
I mean, what do you think? You invited me on to talk about China and perhaps India, and to, you know, talk about the situation that's actually going on in these countries.
This is the situation.
The relation to the United States.
This is the situation.
Not to, you know, discuss abstractly what kind of libertarian form of government would be the best.
Oh, this is exactly what's going on, Robert.
You seem to want to talk about.
This is exactly what's going on.
If that's what you want to talk about, you know, talk about it. But I came on to try and give you some insights into what's actually occurring in these other countries and their relations with the United States.
The range of the social and economic processes that's going on from India, China, and United States is probably the widest opportunity of an example that I've ever witnessed. I've never seen such a large segment that is so wide from total control that's starting to give up that control to much less control that is there's big opportunities here. And I thought you would be
total control doesn't describe the Chinese system. If you want to really talk about it in detail instead of just your image of it, that's fine. The systems are in many ways more similar to each other right now.
That's kind of my point.
Than they were, 30 years ago. And so they don't represent, this enormous range. They're gradations within basically capitalist societies, China being the more statist, in part because it still has remnants of the earlier socialist period, and the U.S. being, the less statist. But they're not really alternate forms of organizing society at this point. They were alternate forms of organizing society during the Mao era, when you actually had a different form of social organization in China. But you really don't have that anymore.
Well, this is my point, Robert.
You're not really talking about radically different examples in this case.
Well, this is my point, is that they were, and we tried it. It's like, I say on the show often,
who's we? Are you talking about,
humanity.
Are you saying?
Humanity. I'm just looking, we've tried a lot of different things, humanity has. And I always say, can we hurry up and get to a police state so we can leave? I mean, once we get to the point that where we have total controls that are the kind of government policies that we have here in America, in just as you talked about earlier with the right to protest and so on, well, we saw what happened in Tiananmen. Well, we got the same kind of stuff that we're building up to here. We got, Patriot Acts that's building. They're just waiting for the next Tiananmen Square, and I suspect Washington will treat it the same way that Chinese did. So I'm going, okay. So now we had this wide range, and it's starting to come down to where you look at the different colors on a map, and Stefan Molyneux, a guest I've had on before, an anarchist, he goes, it's just farms. We're just livestock. It's just, what is the best livestock management tool that we can get the most productivity out of the people inside these geographic areas to in service of something? I don't know, the banks or the countries or the elite or whatever. So we had a wide range from India that was a colony of the British Empire, China that was more autonomous and Asian culture and on their own, the United States, and exactly what you're saying, they're starting to merge into this most productive livestock management system that creates, under the illusion of private property and property rights and individual rewards and so on, you get the most productivity out of them. But then your concern is that you miss some kind of a social obligation that these governments would have to the lives of the individual. So I'm going, how are we to address that? What is it that we would have as we become more productive and we have a stratification of people? You have the elite and the rich and the more wealthy and productive, and you have people that are left behind. How are we going to address that? So I would think you would be the person to ask that.
Well, as I said earlier, if you ask a lot of working class Chinese, they will say that they actually had a better existence under the collectivized system than they do now, because their economic level was not very high, but they had all kinds of social benefits and protections that they've now lost. So, and in India, the bulk of the working classes are in a similar situation, not to speak of the United States today. So, that's part of your answer, is that a lot of working people all over the world feel that other alternative forms of organizing society along a more socialistic approach are actually beneficial for them, not for the people at the top, not for the Wall Street bankers and the Chinese and Indian billionaires, but for actual working people.
Robert Weil, author of Red Cat, White Cat, China, and the Contradictions of Market Socialism. I think our goals are a lot more similar than he thinks. We're just looking at it in a different way.
Well, I wouldn't be too sure about that.
Okay.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readersoffreedomsphoenix.com get every day. Readersoffreedomsphoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already moved. Toured.